Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, Kat. Happy December.
We're coming off like 2 hours of podcasting already, so we may be a little loopy in this one.
Just slightly.
And of course, we were
all the cough syrup I drank.
We were up last night during the US Gamer Slumber Party covering the Game Awards.
Oh, God. And like, I did not finish until like midnight because I think Mike was like, I said, how long is this show? It's like, oh, I think it's about an hour. But poor Jeff Keighley, like, this is obviously his child and he loves it very, very much. I had fun, but he wants us all to watch it, to love it as much as he
it
does.
It means something.
He wouldn't let us go, like that episode of The Simpsons where like Krusty was so lonely he didn't want to leave The Simpsons house until like Milhouse started crying about how he wanted to go home.
It does its best to honor games, but at the end of the day, it's still the show that gives more time to trailers than actual award categories a lot of time.
Yeah, speaking of RPGs, it's like, and here's the RPG of the year. It's Monster Hunter. Okay, see ya. It didn't even get like an award ceremony. It's just...
No. Yeah, he went through like four major categories and then was just like, okay, continuing onward. Like he
another anti-vaping commercial.
He brushed right past Monster Hunter World and like the RPG category, one of the most major categories in my humble opinion. But
I
gave
agree.
Like tons of time to the freaking esports category.
Yeah. That's right. That was certainly a thing.
You can tell where my biases lie, by the way.
No, it is a little silly, especially since it wasn't just RPGs. He was like, oh, and by the way, God of War won action-adventure game, too. That's kind of an important category.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's a good show, and you can tell that it's becoming more and more of a thing. Like, people actually care about it. I went to a freaking pre-awards party. I mean, so...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's definitely less of a farce than when Spike had it.
Oh, way less of a farce. But speaking of a farce... Let's talk about this episode, we're going to be talking about the year in RPGs for 2018. And man, it's just been another year of RPGs and there is a whole lot to cover. But first, as usual, busy week over on US Gamer. I posted my Super Smash Brothers Ultimate review, or at least the first 20 hours of it, because I wasn't able to cover the online right away. We, as I already mentioned, covered the Game Awards, and there were some interesting announcements in there, including Joker being in Super Smash Brothers. Are you excited about that, Nadia?
Well, it's like I was watching the Game Awards over on my computer because I was working through it, as you know, and my husband was watching over here on the couch, and my feed was a little bit ahead of his, so I just started making these like sounds like a wounded animal. And I think he was probably wondering what the hell is going on, but he was watching the feed with, I don't know if you're familiar with Loading Ready Run.
Nope.
It's just basically a group of very clean-cut Canadian kids who do Desert Bus for Hope. And one of the women who was like on that feed and commenting on the Game Awards is Kathleen, who's a major Persona fan. So apparently she was making the same noises as I was. So he had this negative feedback loop of squealing.
Yeah, I think I was slightly behind everybody because everybody suddenly starts going, holy crap, on our Slack.
That's always the best.
So, like, I mean, Persona 5 pops up and I'm like, an invitation. Oh, man, Persona 5 Crimson is totally going to get announced on the Switch.
Yeah, finally.
Hooray. Ooh. And then I was like going, this doesn't seem like Smash Brothers. Okay, that's a good reveal. I was not expecting that. That kind of caught me off guard, and that's a good reveal right there.
Yeah, as they say, that you never saw it coming.
Everybody thinks that this is the prelude to Nintendo announcing that Persona 5, at least, is going to be coming to the Switch, because, I mean, why would they be doing this otherwise?
Yeah, I have a hard time believing that this, like, there's actually a rumor going around that it is going to be coming, and it is going to be called Persona 5 Reloaded, which I think is bullshit. It should be The Crimson. And they're saying that supposedly we're going to hear about it when Joker comes to Smash officially, which is the first character DLC pack, and I can't remember when that comes out.
Man, I am so pumped for Joker to be on this. I mean, it's already a loaded roster, and that's just one more awesome character to be on there.
God, he's going to be yeah, he's going to be able to use, like, well, obviously he has Arsène Lupin as his one of his attacks, so I wonder if he can use, like, other personas or how that's going to work.
Yeah, he'll have his I imagine that he'll have different personas for, like, his down B, forward B, up B, and, like, there will be a projectile persona, that kind of thing. And then he'll also be, like, his neutral B might be his gun. And A would be, like, his sword.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, so that's just how I imagine
it's good speculation, though.
Though, like, I mean, Sakurai tends to be a lot more interesting with his character designs than that, so we could have a very mechanically interesting character.
We could, and one thing that makes me excited for it is Nintendo put so much work into using other people's characters in Smash. Like, they are just so respectful of them. And, like, they did far more for Mega Man during his down years than Capcom did.
They did a really good job of putting Cloud into Smash Brothers, and it's just a bummer that, like, they did a phenomenal job of realizing the Midgar stage in there. And, like, it's a really fun stage with the summons appearing in the background that you can get from the materia. And Cloud himself is fun to play with, though he's pretty overpowered, actually.
Yeah, he is. He's also a little bit too lightweight for me, but yeah.
Yeah, well, he's, like, ridiculously overpowered for me. Like, whenever I'm playing as him, like, my friend, who I would say is better than me on a neutral field, or at least with his best characters, like, more or less can't touch me, which tells me that Cloud is not... He is really overpowered.
A little OP, yes.
The other game, I think the biggest news to come out of the Game Awards, and it was a big RPG-related thing, and we covered it already, was The Outer Worlds, which is Obsidian's first really big RPG in several years. Pillars of Eternity and everything is great. I have a ton of respect for them, but they are going for a very hardcore audience. This is Obsidian kind of shooting for the moon. And I think everybody's a little surprised that it's not going to be an Xbox One exclusive, but also that's good because it's going to hit the widest possible audience. And holy moly, like, there's so much to unpack here, okay? First of all, it's being developed by, like, Tim Kaine, who, like, developed the original Fallout. That is massive.
That's huge.
And not only, I want to say not only Fallout, but also Vampire the Masquerade, which was on our top 25 RPG countdown back when he was at Troika. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one, but I'm pretty sure that was the case. Like, he's responsible for some of the best RPGs ever made. And if anybody is going to be making a 3D Fallout game, you want them to be that, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, everything about it just screams awesome. I mean, it's a good-looking game. It's very colorful and vibrant and lively. You're in a spaceship. It's like Firefly. I mean, but it's Fallout also in space. And all I could think was, oh my God, this game's going to eat Starfield's lunch.
Yeah, well, it's also that. And just, like, it made Obsidian look really good when Bethesda is not looking very good at all.
This is, like, the perfect capper to Bethesda's absolutely horrific year. I mean, Fallout 76
really
was just a catastrophe, and they had the personal data leak thing, and now Obsidian of all companies, comes out and dunks on
lunch. And dunks on, yes.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous. And, okay, like, maybe not, let's not get ahead of ourselves, maybe it will bite off more than it can chew. It's hard to imagine Obsidian
possible.
Having the firepower to really do this game justice. For one thing, it already doesn't have romances, which, no having sex with my companions, that sucks. What am I going to do? It's a bummer.
Closing the book on this one now. And, no sex in space.
And Obsidian games are notoriously buggy.
Yeah.
Like,
but so are Bethesda games.
But what was it? Especially Bethesda, but especially Obsidian. I mean, they are peas in a pod. The funny thing is, like, there's kind of a rivalry going on behind the scenes with Obsidian and Bethesda. Like, Bethesda is, like, they don't like to talk about Fallout New Vegas because they it seems to really annoy them that Fallout New Vegas is considered the best of the 3D Fallout games. Like, that actually seems to be a sore point for them. And I have seen my share of eye rolling behind the scenes from Obsidian about Bethesda's RPGs. Like, they'll talk the talk and they'll say all the... Both sides will say nice things about one another, you know, in public. And they're like, yeah, we love Bethesda, blah, blah, blah. Fallout, we've had a great partnership over the years. But go behind the scenes and there's some serious disrespect, especially for Fallout 4.
Yeah, I'm sure that once the kind of the PR switch is turned off, it's just like, rah, 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 rah.
Oh, God, yes. No, I've been there. Like, I listened to it for myself. So that tells you all you need to know. So this is Obsidian's chance to come out here and basically go, yeah, well, now we've got, guess what, guys? We've got the big, big first-person RPG sandbox open-world game with tons of amazing quests and things to do and freedom. And if they can pull this off, oh my God, like, this is pushing Obsidian to a new level as a developer. Like, if they can nail this, this is, like, huge for them. This is putting them on CD Projekt Red, like, level, right?
That's true. That's true. And if CD Projekt Red pulled it off, then, I mean, I guess Obsidian could, too. Although, there's also the fact that, well, you had another example of a small team, Hello Games, taking on a very, very ambitious project. And
well, they're bigger, they're bigger than Hello Games because they're, like, traditionally more...
That's true. Hello Games is very small.
And the thing that kind of gives me pause also is that a lot of the people who worked on Fallout New Vegas are gone.
That's true.
But at the same time, apparently Obsidian's been working on this game for quite a few years. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, like, everything about this game seems to be on the level. And, I mean, it's got an impeccable pedigree. And it just became my most anticipated game of 2019.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll see more or hear more at E3. I'm guessing we will.
I mean, I would say that's probably a given. I really hope that Cyberpunk comes out next year, because if that's the case, then we've just got a incredible 1-2 punch of RPGs.
Very scientific RPGs, too.
Very scientific RPGs. Okay, Nadia. Science RPG, science fiction RPGs, at least.
I meant science, science fiction.
I love science.
The idea. I love science. All those freaking spaceships going up to the freaking moon. We're going to breathe on the freaking surface.
Anyway, go check out our coverage on US Gamer. And the other thing, and this is just a small note, Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3 is back. And I mean, this goes all the way back to the X-Men Legends games on the PlayStation 2, I want to say. Basically, overhead Diablo-type RPGs with superheroes. The last Marvel Ultimate Alliance wasn't super great, but, I mean, hopefully this is good. It's being made by Team Ninja for some reason.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a shocker, wasn't it?
Yeah, very strange. So there you have it. All the biggest news, Nadia, from the Game Awards was RPG-related, which is not surprising because it's the best genre.
Yeah, too bad it didn't get its own category.
what a shame. But we are going to give it its very own podcast. And Nadia, let's talk about the year that was RPGs in the year of our Lord, 2018. So Nadia, as we look at all of the games that came out this year, so I'm looking at a list of RPGs that came out in 2018, and let's remember some games, okay?
Yes.
Monster Hunter World came out in January.
I feel like it was so long ago and yet so close. Like, you know how that is. But yes, it did actually come out in January. It was a great game.
It feels like
good
500
way to
years
year.
Ago based on the current political cycle and everything else that's been happening.
Yes.
I mean, I there are some things that happened this year that I'm like, that happened this year? What?
Exactly.
Ni No Kuni 2, Revenant Kingdom, which was nominated
for
Best RPG.
I remember Katie and I were like, oh my God, if this gets Best RPG, I'm going to shit.
That was like when Detroit Become Human was nominated for Best Narrative, and we were just like, I forgot it got nominated.
Like, Detroit, I'm pushing for you, come on.
Vampire, which we didn't give a super great review to. Kingdom Come Deliverance, yay. It's like Fallout in the Eastern Europe. And we'll talk about we'll get back to that one. Fallout 76 Fair to say that one didn't really live up to expectations?
A little bit.
Pillars of Eternity 2, Deadfire, which, criminally underappreciated, did not sell well. That's the dark side of Obsidian, I want to say.
Yeah.
Octopath Traveler, the darling of the summer.
I really enjoyed that. I know you weren't a huge fan, but I liked it a lot.
I thought it was cool. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was fine.
To who am I thinking of then? Someone really didn't like it. But
I didn't say I really disliked it. I think it's a cool game.
Yeah, I know the format wasn't for everyone, but it struck a chord with me, so I just ate it right up. It was a good summer game.
Valkyria Chronicles 4, which you were a big fan of.
It took me a while to get into it, but once the story really gets going, it goes pretty hard. And the characters at first, I wasn't sure if I liked them, but as the story went on, I was like, okay, yeah, I like him enough to stick with it. And I really like the squad stories. I think those were a really great addition.
I agree. Actually, the squad stories were a really terrific addition. It's funny. I loved the original Valkyria Chronicles so much, but Valkyria Chronicles 4 just did not hit as hard for me. And I think it's just because it's not 2008 anymore.
Yeah.
It's HD, like HD anime is not the incredible novelty that it was in the past.
Right.
And I mean, it's not like the levels are poorly designed. Actually, I think they're well designed for the most part. I just didn't have the patience to spend an hour and change on every mission for the most part. After a while, the review started to feel like a bit of a slog as I was just trying to get through the missions to get to the end.
Yeah, I could see, to be fair, I was going at my own pace. I didn't have to review the game, but you did. And I could see how it would be kind of a stressful game by the end, because there are some of the last missions are real B-I-C-T-H, especially when you're up against the twins.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, you can't shoot them. They duck everything. And that's really frustrating.
Actually, I was able to lead the twins right into my tank's guns. And and as they were trying to run past, they were just getting shot up by my machine
Jesus.
Gun. That's the only way. I had forgotten about that aspect of the original Valkyria Chronicles. And I was like, oh, crap. Yeah, so you got to basically lead them into a situation where they're getting crossfired by a whole lot of people while they're running. Because if you just shoot at them, then you're not going to hit them. Or else you have to hit them with grenades or explosions or something.
Oh, I should have done that. Shit, I'm an idiot.
Yeah, no, you got to use your tank's artillery or grenades or something. Because otherwise, they will duck literally everything, even if it's a high chance of getting hit.
Yeah, and that was another thing I really liked about the game, is it kind of added some more mechanics, like the Grenadier, for example.
Yeah, no, I thought it did a really good job of expanding upon the mechanics of the game, mm-hmm. of the actual game, of the Valkyria Chronicles. I thought that the addition of the Grenadier was actually kind of realistic, because, I mean, it has an artillery aspect, but it wasn't super overpowered, because there was stuff that, hard countered. It gave the Lancers a much better thing to do.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about this, but you mentioned to me, you asked me once, what do you think the third game will be, or the Valkyria Chronicles 5 as it is, where do you think that will take place? And there actually are hints in the game, especially the squad stories, that it will take place in the quote-unquote Far East.
Oh, so like Japan.
Yeah, there's actually a character who you learn in the squad stories who's a spy for the Far East.
The Far East. It's such a World War II
thing.
That's
what they literally call it. It is.
That reminds me of Fire Emblem, where it was a medieval game for so long, and then they introduced the Hoshidens, or samurai.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they just wanted an excuse to introduce samurai and stuff, and it worked out well. But, I mean, it was just, I could see something similar with Valkyria Chronicles.
Here come more samurai.
If Valkyria Chronicles is set in World War II, that introduces some uncommon, uncomfortable themes, I think, for a Far East, quote-unquote, type nation.
Yeah, I don't want to give away any spoilers, but the kind of the end game for Valkyria Chronicles 4 is I know what they're kind of doing a commentary on here.
Continuing on through the games that came out this year, the RPGs, Dark Souls Remastered, if you'll remember that. It's weird how that one, it feels a little bit like it passed under the radar, but maybe that's because, everybody's played Dark Souls so much at this point.
Yeah, and I played quite a bit of it on PlayStation 4 because that was my first Dark Souls experience, and I really enjoyed it, but I just kind of bounced after a while.
Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which I think I was being a little harsh on in our other conversation.
Yeah, you said it got steamrolled by RDR2. Which, well, I mean, you're not totally wrong.
Well, it did from like a popular standpoint, but I was being a little mean about the mechanics. I think it's fine. I think it's still more action game Assassin's Creed than it is full-blooded RPG.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wouldn't say that it's as deep from a storytelling or mechanical standpoint as The Witcher, which it clearly wants to be.
Yeah, and it's like, Assassin's Creed is one of those series where I know it's, like, redeemed itself, and I actually really liked Syndicate.
Mm.
And that was one that flew under everyone's radar, but I haven't played the series since, and I know it's really improved itself since, and I have to kind of get back into that.
Origins is much better, yeah.
Yeah, I know, it probably is, but I could see with Syndicate, they were trying hard to start saying, okay, you know what, we're going to have better characters, so at least I started with that.
Assassin's Creed fans characters. Are salty because Assassin's Creed Odyssey, like, pretty definitively signals that, yeah, they're going full Witcher with this series, and the point where they hired Mike Laidlaw, former lore master slash director slash producer slash designer of Dragon Age.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could end up being a really interesting RPG going forward. I think it doesn't help that I don't really care about ancient Greece, and I'm looking for a better setting than that.
Yeah, I liked ancient Greece and mythology a lot when I was, like, younger. But so I remember a lot of it, and I have an interest in it through that. But it is kind of, like, overdone in video games. Unless you're doing, like, Kid Icarus and just go completely freaking wild with it. That's awesome.
I'm not sure which time period I would want them to be in at this point because they've done so many time periods. They've done ancient Egypt. They've done, like, they did, the Industrial Revolution, the French Revolution, and the American Revolution. They did, like, Renaissance Italy, right? And if they did the Middle Ages or that kind of thing, they would just be going back to what? Medieval fantasy, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I would almost kind of, like, my first thought was, it'd be kind of cool if they did this, but with World War I.
Right.
Or, I don't know, that time
period. I was
actually
thinking, like, ancient Ireland or something. That'd be
ancient
kind of
Ireland, the Gaelic.
Yeah.
Gaelic, the Gauls. Yeah. Or is it the Gauls? No. No, I don't know. I think, the Gauls are where in France. That's it. Yeah. But yeah, the Gaelic people. Oh, that could be interesting. I was like going, I don't want them to do the same old, same old. They've always said that they'll only do Japan when they're really out of ideas or they're desperate.
That's the end of the road, Japan.
There's been talk of like doing like Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
It would be, but I've never cared about that kind of story, so...
That if he puts an interesting spin on it, maybe, but...
My housemaid is a huge Romance of the Three Kingdoms fan, though, and he's told me some pretty wild stories from, like, that saga, so that could be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Other games that came out this year, Bard's Tale 4, another game that flew under the radar, and we didn't cover that much, but it's from Brian Fargo. I don't have much to say about Bard's Tale 4. I was kind of busy when it came out.
Sorry.
I'm really sorry about that. I'm sure it's a very interesting game, and it's an interesting game, and it's a notable game, but I can't get to everything. Same, too, with Underworld Ascendant, which a lot of people have categorized as a disappointment, actually.
Ouch.
Like, I was reading some reviews of this one. It's got, like, a 5 out of 10 on Steam, and it just doesn't seem to have landed with people.
That's too bad.
Oh, God. 1.5 stars on IGN and 1 star on Eurogamer. Though, I don't know what 1 star means. It must be a void.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it means, like, pour acid on it and shove it out the door.
I guess. It got an avoid from Eurogamer.
Oh, avoid the noid.
The Underworld Ascendant is positively paranoid that you'll forget that it's an immersive sim. A crowdfunded successor to Looking Glass's landmark RPG Ultima Underworld, created with the input of Looking Glass veterans like Warren Spector. Its dialogue is full of allusions to the genre's ethos of player improvisation using flexible tools. And then it goes on to say, in any case, Ascendant's immersive sim premise doesn't really flatter it because it means you're actively looking for breakages and limitations you can take advantage of. And there are ever so many of them to find. It's certainly a game about experimentation in the sense that a lot of it doesn't work. That's a bummer. Because the original Underworld, Ultima Underworld, was one of the initial kind of immersive sims, like play around with the environment. Mm-hmm. Like it is, it was a big deal in that regard, and it sounds like Underworld Ascendant didn't really work. I actually played Underworld Ascendant, I think, at E3, and I wasn't impressed either. I've heard... Go ahead.
Oh, just did they say that was kickstarted?
Yeah, I said crowdfunded, yeah.
Crowdfunded. It's always a little disappointing when something like that happens. You hear, oh, can I get a successor finally, and we're going to crowdfund it, it's going to be great, and then just kind of flopped.
Yeah, somebody who I talked to who did actually play Underworld Ascendant said that it initially is doing the immersive sim stuff, and then it seems to lose confidence in that, and then becomes more of a straight-up dungeon crawler, and neither of them work.
That's a shame.
The new World of Warcraft expansion came out, and I haven't talked to Mike about it since it came out. It sounds like it's a little, I want to say, controversial?
Yeah, I know that when it came out, there was some controversy surrounding it, but I think I heard that Blizzard fixed what the problem was, and since then, I haven't heard much about it, so either everyone forgot or they actually did fix it.
The Banner Saga officially ended on a very depressing note.
It started on a depressing note.
Yeah, Hiran Cryer, our guides editor, wrote a really good review of it, and you should go check that out over on the site. And then I'm maybe the biggest RPG of the fall, which is kind of crazy to say, but Pokemon Let's Go?
I really, really enjoyed Pokemon Let's Go, and it absolutely is not a hardcore Pokemon game, though I did still find it challenging, like the after game. And I just like how cute and fun and immersive it is. That's, I don't know, it's funny how Pokemon seems to rescue us in our darkest hours sometimes.
Funny how it seems to rescue us in our darkest hours. Well, let's talk about Pokemon Let's Go for a moment. I'm having a hard time getting into it, Nadia.
Oh, that's too bad. How come?
I think it's because it's just too kiddie. It's so simple that it's not really holding my attention. There's like no tension whatsoever. I don't feel like there's a lot to build upon. I've always said that I'm always trying to rush to get through the story, which is an overblown tutorial. But I mean, in this case, that's kind of all there is. And yeah, I know that you said that there's stuff to do afterward for sure. Like there's post-game content, there's catching Mewtwo, there's challenging the master trainers and everything. And maybe, as I said in an earlier episode, maybe that works. But I just don't feel a lot of motivation to work to that point because it strips down a lot of the mechanics from the core games. And it's charming and cute, but really easy.
Do you still kind of feel like the series is good without the random encounters, for example?
Oh, yeah. I actually like the catching a lot better in this one. But it also gives you XP when you catch stuff, and it's almost like, oh, okay, yeah, like it obviates a lot of the need for grinding and that kind of thing, but it also makes me feel like I have to do no work.
No, I can't really say that. Maybe I'm just a Pokemon idiot, which is very,
you're
very
possible.
You're
not a Pokemon idiot, Nadia. You're very smart.
Well, it's just like, I don't know, And I know I'm not the only one. I know Jason Wilson was agreeing with me on this one, but there were times when I actually was like, oh, okay, this is actually a bit of a challenge.
Like when?
And was it Route 13? That horrible route with the damn picket fences. Like, by the time that was done, I was like, oh, God, that was, I did not prepare for this, or I just wasn't ready, or I don't know what I did, but I feel kind of dead. So there was that.
I feel and, kind of dead. The Pokemon Let's Go experience.
And I still think that they really upped the challenge on Mewtwo by not letting you just, you know, lob a Master Ball at him from the start.
Yes, I agree with you on all of that front. I think, though, that it is an example of Pokemon moving away a little bit from its hardcore RPG roots. And make no mistake, Pokemon is a hardcore RPG at its heart. That's why I've played it for so many years, and why it has a tournament scene, and why people care about it so much, because it has a hardcore fan base who keep it interest going even during the lean times. Like, you get through the game, you go, wow, that was a really cool game. I really enjoyed it. Oh my God, there's this massive hardcore community all around the world who are really, really into it. And now there's an entirely new dimension of this game that I didn't even realize. And that was me with Pokemon for sure. And I don't know if there's anything like that to go to in Pokemon Let's Go. Like, I can't imagine probably a reason not to, like, really get up to level 100 in this game.
No, you're probably right about that, unless you, like, really want to for some reason. Like, I don't even think challenging the Masters requires that kind of dedication.
Nah.
But it is definitely Fisher-Price Pokemon, but not in a bad way. It very much does make me look forward to Generation 8. And I think both of us can agree that getting furiously angry over the game like some people have is just not the way to go.
Oh, I mean, who is furiously angry about this game?
You'll find there was a note. There was a story on, I think it was Nintendo Life, about how they're talking about putting Go elements into other Pokemon games, possibly. And but they didn't really specify what. For all we know, that could just be like, oh, well, you can transfer Pokemon from Go to Pokemon whatever, and you know, I could see that still being the case. But just people were just in the comments were just like banging like war drums, like Pokemon is ruined, the casuals have ruined it, this is terrible. If you like this game, you know, that means you've ruined Pokemon. Thanks so much. And there was someone, I don't know if you saw the comment someone left on my story about saying how, oh, the after game is a lot of fun in Pokemon Let's Go, and someone's like, yeah, you're paid off for even saying that's true. Like, a paid-off reviewer, I think he called
it. So we're seeing the real schism between the traditional Pokemon fans and perhaps the people who have embraced Pokemon Go and Pokemon Let's Go.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Pokemon has been around for so long. People have been complaining about casual since the beginning of time, practically, like, you know, like, since the Game Boy Advance era, at least.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I do think that Pokemon Go and Pokemon, you know, the mainline Pokemon games can exist in peace and, in fact, can learn from one another. Like I said, I think that random encounters should go away. And
yeah, I totally agree.
I think that Pokemon Let's Go was a proof of concept that a Pokemon game without random encounters can be still equally surprising and maintain mm-hmm. that surprise factor while also getting rid of the... I mean, I'm sorry. Like, I don't understand why people would like random encounters. Explain it to me. Explain it, because
don't look
it's
at me.
Just a pain. You're walking through
no,
a dungeon
totally
and you're like, with every step, you're like flinching because it might transition into a battle scene. And then you have to go through a rote series of commands to get through it. At its worst, yeah. You have to grind to get through it. And these are outdated mechanics. They are.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And
something you said earlier struck a chord with me, because you said there are still surprises without random encounters. And you're absolutely right. Like, I was flying around on Charizard at some point, and it's like, oh, I'm looking for Magikarp, some loser Pokemon. Like, holy crap, a Dragonite just appeared out of nowhere.
It just, yeah, like, having the enemies on the field allows for much more dynamic and interesting things to deal with. And...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tell me what a random encounter like adds to a game versus not having it. Like, is it just tradition? Or the only reason that you would have random encounters is to kind of making a battle of attrition where
yeah.
you are trying to get through a dungeon or whatever, and you have a finite number of items and that kind of thing, and you keep end up getting into battles. And it's, I guess, hearkening back to Dungeons & Dragons a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a surprise factor to it, maybe. But for the most part, I don't think that's necessarily better than... I don't think that a rote battle of attrition and a grind is better than interesting, dynamic, tactical choices and deciding whether to make... engage in an encounter, deciding whether or not to engage in an encounter,
mm-hmm.
being able to have mm-hmm. enemies on the map screen who can do interesting things. I don't like it. And the best thing,
no, sir,
the best thing ever was when I stepped into the long grass for the first time and I was like, wait a minute. Oh, something's not going to jump out. I don't have to wear max repel all the time while trying to push boulders. And, oh, look, there's an interesting Pokemon right over there. I can go and try and catch it. Oh, look, a Butterfree is going. I'm going to go and try and catch that. It made Pokemon at least 10% more interesting.
I agree. And I'm really hoping, like, they really seize on that for Generation 8.
Yeah, I can hear longtime Pokemon fans ripping their hair out. This is a controversial thing over on US Gamer. I have seen it. Some of our readers have said, no, Kat, you are wrong. It's not outdated, and I get really mad when you say that. Well, come at me. Tell me why it's not outdated. Tell me why random encounters are good. I want to know. Just tell me, okay? Tell me on the Twitter. Tell me on somewhere. But tell me why.
The gauntlet has been thrown
tell
down.
Tell me why random encounters aren't a garbage mechanic that should be gone from everything forever.
You had strong opinions about random encounters.
Thank God, it's gone from most RPGs. I can't name many RPGs that still have random encounters. Pokemon was like one of the last holdouts.
Yeah, Octopath had them, which made me a little bit mad because you could reduce them a bit, which was good. But in my opinion, if you're going to have random encounters, if you absolutely must have them, then do like Bravely Default and let people turn them off when they want to.
The best thing about Pokemon Let's Go is my friend bought it, and he's playing it with his three-year-old daughter, and he's now texting to me about the experiences. Apparently, she is absolutely adoring it, as we would expect. She loves Pikachu. She's discovering the wonder of Pikachu for the very first time. She made friends with some kid in her class talking about how they both love Pikachu.
Aww, my heart.
Her favorite Pokemon is Magikarp.
Good for her.
She's very excited to show me her Pokemon the next time I come and visit.
Aww.
I mean, it is ridiculously cute. And, like, I always talked about how Pokemon is, like, RPGs for kids, and then Pokemon Let's Go is RPGs literally for babies. Well, here we are. Like, is for a baby.
That is pretty much what Game Freak made it for, and so I can't fault them on that. And anyone who does is probably being like, okay, if you're gonna bitch about Pokemon not being hardcore enough, wait until Gen 8, please.
Yeah, but like, you know, as a hardcore Pokemon fan, like, I look at Pokemon Let's Go, it's cute, it's charming in so many ways, like, that is almost enough to keep me going, but I'm not feeling a huge amount of motivation to be like, I gotta get through this, I love this so much. This is really, like, touching the part of me that wants, like, a really in-depth strategic experience, which Pokemon can do. And yes, it doesn't feel like Pokemon Let's Go has capacity for. And so that's why, and I think a lot of the hardcore Pokemon fans are afraid that this is going to end up being so successful, and Pokemon Go is going to be so successful, that it's going to end up infecting Gen 8 somehow.
I don't know. I think Game Freak is a very smart.
Got announced.
Yeah, but then they said, oh, don't worry, Gen 8's coming out, which to me says, okay, they know what Pokemon Hardcore is versus, you know, what they have planned for Pokemon Go. So they're not a stupid company. They're a smart company.
I don't know about that. So, okay. They're not a stupid company, but could you imagine a scenario where they see so much success from making Let's Go and Go casual that they double down on making Gen 8 casual?
I don't know if they have to do that. Pokemon has always been around. And I feel like Pokemon Go wasn't successful because it's, you know, it's an AR game. It's successful because it's Pokemon.
It's a social game.
And people love Pokemon.
Yeah, people love Pokemon, but they've also done a really good job of building up on it. It's just fun to play with your friends. I mean, mm-hmm. Like Alameda, like where I live, is just Pokemon Go crazy. I mean, there are gyms everywhere. We had a pretty amazing moment the other night, actually. There was a word hit on the Alameda Pokemon Go Discord that there was a perfect Eve Ivy Dratini like around the block. And we all bolted outside. And I kid you not, more than a dozen people were converging on the same location. Cars were pulling up. People were like, where's the perfect Dratini? Ah! It was remarkable. I could not believe it.
That's a lot of fun. And I'm glad that Go has been like improved so much that people are still finding like a lot of fun in it. I got to join a Discord server for something in my area.
Oh, no. Yeah, you totally should. It changes everything because then you can go do raids and stuff. You can do EX raids. Oh, it's so much fun.
Of course, it's winter now, so people are going to be like, oh, I'm staying indoors. But then when you do that, then the freaking Team Instinct comes along to the neighborhood and just starts flipping gyms. And you're like, hey, get out of my neighborhood. What are you doing here?
Team Instinct and flip. What is it with them?
They're opportunists. They're like vultures.
Yeah, like Valor and Mystic are like, grr, grr. And then suddenly Instinct just comes in. And you're like, why is everything yellow? Holy crap.
When did this happen? We were fighting amongst ourselves.
It's like Hufflepuff. Like when the Harry Potter game inevitably comes out and everybody's like Gryffindor and Slytherin and Ravenclaw, like Hufflepuff will unexpectedly take over everything and people are like, what's going on?
How did this happen?
Yeah, I really like Pokemon Go, and they got PvP coming out, and I wrote an article about that over on the site. And I think the PvP really matches the ethos. It's not competitive, it's cooperative in its own weird way, because it doesn't matter who really wins, you both get rewards.
Uh-huh.
And part of me is like, ugh, gross, like both of us get rewards? Come on. Like, what's the point if it's not competitive? But the other part of me is like, that's nice, it's really relaxed and we can just have a good time. So I think that's what the competitive set in Pokemon Gen 8 are afraid of.
Right.
Having fun. But, that's what they're afraid of.
No fun, no cooperation, no nothing. Pokemon is war, Kat.
For what is Pokemon is war?
You heard Lieutenant Surge.
For what it's worth, I think Pokemon Gen 8 is actually going to go the opposite direction and be the hardcore version.
Oh, they're going to be like, okay, you bastards are scared to go. Well, let me show you something else.
All of the hints that I've been hearing, all of the teases and suggestions from the developers has suggested that they are going in a direction of pleasing hardcore fans with Gen 8. Like, get people in the gate with Let's Go and Go, and then show them the real game with Gen 8.
Show them that box from the Hellraiser series. We have such sights to show.
I'm really interested to see where they end up going. I hope they end up picking somewhere bizarre like Canada.
Oh, God, the game of the year right there is Canada.
Yeah. I hope that they don't pick somewhere really, like, I could see them picking, like, London.
Yeah. Tom doesn't even like Pokemon. What's he going to get out of
Pokemon is a globetrotting game now.
I think
Paris.
That's really cool.
They've done a whole bunch of Japan, and they've done Hawaii, and they've done New York, kind of. America.
So,
I don't know. Canada. There you go.
Yeah, and I want to see, like, Canada, like, the cities, too. I don't just want to, like, be like, here's some mountains, some moose. There, you're in Canada now.
Do Africa.
Africa would be really cool.
Africa could be really cool, or it could be really cringeworthy.
Yeah, that is true. If they stick to being, like, hey, here's the savannah, and, like, some really cool kind of flatland Pokemon, that'd be pretty awesome.
I mean, done right, I think Pokemon in Africa could be fascinating. Like, they could have a lot of fun with the characters. Or Australia?
Australia's not a bad idea.
Okay. Let's stop talking about Pokemon. And let's talk about... We've kind of had an overview of the year. And like some of the biggest games, Monster Hunter World, Ni No Kuni 2, Pokemon Let's Go, Kingdom Come, Pillars of Eternity 2, Octopath Traveler, Valkyria Chronicles 4, Fallout 76. Like, what's your overall take on the year of 2018 in RPGs?
It was a good year. Strangely enough, I feel like even though it was a good, solid year and there were some great games, shout out to Dragon Quest XI as well.
Oh my God, I can't believe I forgot about Dragon Quest XI.
You forgot about Dragon Quest XI, Kat, but it
just shows how much I hate Dragon Quest XI.
Yeah, we know you despise
it. Yeah, I'm a hater. I am a big hater. No, keep going.
But I was going to say, my point still stands, and the point I'm making is... It was a year for very good RPGs, but not too many big surprises, like... Nier Automata, the way it usurped just everyone last year and took us all by
Persona
surprise.
5.
Like Persona 5 as well, yes.
That was a lot more surprise for the ages.
That was great. Boom, boom. I thought that was like just, that made like 2017 one of my favorite gaming years ever just for that, because it was just the year that like Japanese RPGs didn't just like have to be in some strange niche sitting over in the corner. Like they just were in like, seeing Persona 5 become part of, like, the mainstream, it's just like, wow, that's incredible.
I think this was the year of Monster Hunter. And I say this because Monster Hunter World transformed the genre, the franchise, from local favorite, regional favorite, to global favorite. It's the best-selling Capcom game of all time. It won Best RPG at the Game Awards. It won over a ton of new fans, myself included. And I've seen Monster Hunter fans fetch about how it doesn't have as many monsters and like it drops a lot of the stuff that they like. Like hardcore fans are weird about all of the time-wasty crap that they have to do. It's like, it's nuance. It's not nuance. It's wasting your time.
This is like the whole random encounters have to be in Pokemon thing.
Yes, it's the crowd that sees streamlining as like really, really bad. Like it's a dirty word. It's the worst possible word that you could possibly have. But for better or worse, Monster Hunter World streamlined the experience. And we still got another Monster Hunter Generations on the 3DS? Switch? No, it was on the Switch.
It was a Switch.
Yeah. And
it was a remake of a 3DS
game.
So
hardcore Monster Hunter fans also got their game. And by and large, like even though it was, I mean, it was kind of the ultimate old school Monster Hunter game for in many ways. But Monster Hunter World, like, it is the game that made it brought Monster Hunter into the big time, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And I'm glad it did because Capcom had been, God, they had been trying and they finally struck gold.
Yeah, well, I mean, turns out you put it on console and you, you have really top level production values and a decent, and nothing else is coming out around it and people are going to be paying attention.
Yeah, they did.
I think the key though, like, just playing Monster Hunter Generations Ultimate, if they had just done that, but put it on the PS4 with pretty graphics, it wouldn't have cut it, because I think it would have been too dense, and people wouldn't have been able to get into it as easily. Whereas Monster Hunter World, by removing a lot of the barriers, removing a lot of the busy work, they opened it up in a way that people could actually engage with it and have fun with it. It was still grindy as hell, especially like getting a lot of the higher level stuff. You're still fighting the same monsters over and over again, trying to break tails and everything. But once you figured out the often wonky multiplayer mechanics, it was really fun.
Yeah, and as I can't remember who said it, but if you're ever in trouble, you fire a flare into the sky, and like three Japanese people come and help you.
No, I was, every time seeing a Japanese username was always brilliant, because I was like, oh, good. Because they would walk in and just be like, bam, 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 and then the monster would be dead, and you'd be like, whoa.
I'm saved.
That's what I would do in Dark Souls as well.
What, do you save people?
No, it's in Dark Souls. Invariably, I'll run into a boss, and the boss will like smash me into the ground. And so I will call in reinforcements in a game like Dark Souls, and somebody will come in. They will come in and like kill the boss in 5 or 6 hits, and then they'll bow to me and disappear.
I love that. That's amazing.
I ended up getting to like level 30 in Monster Hunter World. I completed the story, and the last time I was playing, I was fighting, I think they're called like Basil Juices or something like that. I was fighting two of them at once, and I was like, I want to get Hurin in here to help me out. I don't want to fight this stuff alone, but I never got around to it, which is kind of sad. Like, I ended up moving on, alas.
Yeah, unfortunately that happens when you're in this industry.
But during the Game Awards, they were teasing some big news for Monster Hunter fans.
Yeah,
In
a few days.
I am already anticipating Monster Hunter World Ultimate.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That or some new DLC.
Yeah, it's just a Capcom way to release a updated version with like way more monsters, but it's essentially the same game.
Yeah, that is the Capcom way, trademark.
That will be the real test to see if I'm like willing to get back into it, because I put a lot of work into Monster Hunter World, and when I look back onto it, like, I'm like, oh my god, I did so much grinding in that game, fighting the same monsters over and over and over again, and I don't know if I'm ready to do that again in Monster Hunter World Ultimate. We'll see.
I would hope that they would let you keep your progress, but
yeah,
we'll see indeed.
I'd say the other probably biggest year RPG of the year is probably Octopath Traveler.
Yeah, it cleared a million copies. Like, that was, I heard about that like ages ago, so it must have done even better since.
Yeah, I mean, Octopath Traveler, perfect storm, right? I mean, it was on the Nintendo Switch. It grabbed everybody's attention because it had kind of a unique and interesting visual look to it. It wasn't your just typical top down, or it wasn't it wasn't kind of an ugly like 3D RPG. It wasn't what were they called? See, I can't even remember them. The one from RPG Factory. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, that's like Chrono Trigger? The I Am Setsuna. Lost Sphere.
It's not I Am Setsuna. Like, everybody was really prepared to love I Am Setsuna, and it was really hurt by its extremely low production values and relative simplicity, where Octopath Traveler was kind of the opposite, right? I mean, big, epic RPG with really, like, actually pretty solid production values, or at least the unique visual look covered up actually the somewhat low production values, great soundtrack, and it didn't grab some people, but a lot of people absolutely fell in love. Like, one of my best friends loved Octopath Traveler. Like, she fell head over heels for it, like, played every, like, character, like, soaked it in. Like, it was her game. And for a certain breed of classic JRPG fan, that was it. Octopath Traveler.
Yeah. It's actually funny. My sister-in-law, her brother, messages me on Facebook and says, yeah, I was looking up Octopath Traveler stuff and I found all your writing. I'm like, hey, there Yay. You go. Yay.
I mean, you ended up really liking Octopath Traveler. It was kind of your game.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I don't know if you remember this, but when it crossed a million sold, the artist for the series kind of hinted we might hear something about Bravely Default again sometime
soon.
Oh,
man, that would be nice, because I really liked Bravely Default, too.
Yeah, yeah. I liked Octopath. I liked Bravely Default. I think it's because also both those games, we shouldn't go without mentioning, their battle systems are really interesting. I think Octopath had a great battle system.
I think Octopath Traveler did, in fact, have a good battle system for the most part. Charging up your characters, having some pretty strong abilities and items. In some ways, it was relatively easy, but not too easy. And because you had so many characters, like, you could build up some interesting parties and that kind of thing. And it was cool just picking your character, traveling around the world. It was a real throwback in many ways.
Yeah, and I know some people have criticized the way the characters don't interact with each other, but I really liked the stories for most of the individual characters. They really grew on me.
And for better or worse, this is the year of Fallout 76.
Yeah. That's a game, isn't it?
I mean, we've already talked about it in the previous segment when we were talking about The Outer Worlds, but I don't think it can be overstated, like, what a bad year it was for Bethesda. Like,
it really was. And I'm thinking back to when I went to the preview event over at the Greenbrier, and I'm noticing, like, all this jank and, like, you know, stuttering and bugs and what have you, and Bethesda reassured us, oh, no, this is a totally old build we made just for this particular event. You know, we're way ahead on correcting bugs and stuff over back home. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll take your word for it. And I did.
I mean, you got to take their word for it, right? What are you going to do? Call them a liar? Liar!
Yeah. No, you suck. Liars.
I guess with Fallout 76, it was just a misbegotten project from the beginning. And my understanding was that it used to be a multiplayer mode that was intended for Fallout 4, but became a game. And that's never a great thing, necessarily.
No, it isn't. And on one hand, I feel like, okay, they tried something new, but it wasn't just a matter of, okay, they tried something new, it didn't catch on. They just bungled it at every step, like the data loss, the pre-order, you know, scandals. It was just, it did not go well for them on any front. Baggate.
On the one hand, I was rolling my eyes like at the outrage over it. On the other hand, I was also kind of like, so Bethesda sent me like one of those power armor things, which unbidden, I didn't really want it. I'm planning on getting rid of it at some point. I went and checked, and sure enough, there was a crappy nylon bag in there. And if you actually did spend X amount of money and you were expecting a good canvas bag, like, I would be, like, feeling a little annoyed that I got that crappy bag.
Yeah, and there was also controversy because, yes, they gave the people at the event a knapsack, though. It was a knapsack, not the bag that they advertised in the pre-order. So some people were like, well, why did they get that? And we didn't get our thing.
Yeah. I think people have been waiting to take the knives out with Bethesda for quite a while.
They have. There are, like, a lot of people who, to be fair, are like, thank you, we have tolerated Bethesda's, like, glitches and stuff for way too long. But this goes way beyond, like, some goofy-ass glitches.
Well, I think that with Skyrim and Fallout 4 in particular, people have always been like, what? These games come out and look at all these insane glitches, and they always get a free pass on them. Why do they always get a free pass? And, I mean, in fairness, games like Wolfenstein are really good, so, I mean, and Doom, so I don't know how you could call them all really glitchy, but, yeah, no, like, Skyrim and Fallout 4 definitely were glitch fests for the most part, but we tolerated them because, I mean, Skyrim was a wonderful, beautiful, watered-down Morrowind that captured a lot of people. Getting back to that streamlining thing. And
yes.
And Fallout 4, like, it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, but ultimately a lot of people still liked it, and I was one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you loved it. But I know some people who will, like, just, you know, spit on you if you mention it in their vicinity.
And yeah, ultimately we were tolerating the bugs of Fallout 4 because we got really interesting stories and some great companions.
Exactly.
And settlement building and a cool world and that kind of thing. And it's kind of like if in Red Dead Redemption 2, you stripped out all of the story and all of the interesting characters and most of the encounters, and suddenly you're left with a game with really bad controls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would not be getting any Game of the Year awards.
Sure would not. And without Fallout 76, that's what they did. They stripped out everything that people actually like about Fallout and in a misbegotten attempt to turn it into some kind of service game. And it really blew up in their face. And man, they must be really like wincing behind the scenes right now. And yeah, man, wow. And they spent a lot of money marketing this thing. They clearly were like going, okay, it's going to be one of the biggest games of the year. And it was supposed to be one of the biggest games of the year.
It was supposed to be.
Everybody was waiting for it to be the biggest game of the year, and it's the biggest flop of the year.
It's the biggest disaster of the year is what it is. And I'm actually really curious to see what they do for damage control in the coming months.
I take no pleasure in this.
No, neither do I.
I do not like dunking on bad games and or expensive failures, but it sure seems like Bethesda really made their own bet on this one, and they got I don't know what they can do with it short of like completely remaking it. I wouldn't be surprised if they just kind of quietly drop support for it. But this is going to hurt them going forward.
It is. People aren't going to forget about this. And you're absolutely right. I take no pleasure in it either. I mean, I talked to a lot of the devs at the event I was at. And, you know, they're regular people. They're very proud of their work, and they work very hard. And they were terrified of this kind of thing happening, like where it just all blows up in their face. So I think about them a lot.
I wonder if they were going for something really experimental for the most part, and it just didn't work, right? I mean, like they're going,
yeah.
Well, like, couldn't you imagine in their pitch doc, kind of something like, okay, there will be no NPCs because other players will be the NPCs.
Right,
and
yeah.
Your stories will come from the environmental storytelling and the other people. And you will go on adventures together. And there will be a single player aspect to satisfy the core fan base. But because one of our core pillars is not having NPCs, we'll make it kind of almost like a ghost story.
Right.
And on paper, I bet that sounded really good.
Yeah, on paper, I was like, oh, you know what? I'll give that a try. When I was at the event, though, it sounded like they do have plans for DLC, including I asked them, like, hey, is there a chance we could have a robot companion? And they were like, yeah, that's actually a really good idea. So
good job, Nadia. You helped them out.
If you see a robot, you can thank me.
The core of Fallout is the really interesting stories that you get from the side quests and the vignettes. It's like an anthology of Twilight Zone stories, and you take that away completely in Fallout 76, and I just don't know how you salvage it.
No, you're absolutely right when you say that nobody really goes to Fallout for the fantastic combat.
Certainly not. I know I do. I know I don't. So, yeah. And then looking ahead, I mean, Starfield sounds like it's the next thing that Bethesda is going to be putting out. And when it's inevitably announced, I think people are going to be, it's going to be viewed through the lens of Fallout 76.
Yeah, it absolutely will. So they're definitely going to be, or if they know what's good for them, they're definitely going to be stepping a little more carefully from now on.
And meanwhile, they got the Outer Worlds nipping at them.
Yeah, absolutely. A little competition never hurt
anyone. Of course, in a year or so, we could all be going, man, the Outer Worlds, what a piece of crap that turned out to be. Who knows?
What a piece of trash.
Well, that sure was buggy, wasn't it? It didn't even work. It like kept crashing on me. But I don't think so. I mean, I don't think so. And I think Yeah, you're right. This is like sports games, like games like NBA 2K and FIFA need the competition to push them and push them hard to mm-hmm. put out their best work, to not settle. And I don't think they were settling. I don't think Bethesda was settling per se with Fallout 76, but perhaps they were a little too comfortable with bugs.
Yeah, they're a little too confident that people will just buy it because it's Bethesda and it's Fallout, not necessarily thinking about why people buy Bethesda and Fallout games.
So looking at the rest of the landscape of RPGs, I mean, I feel like I've said my piece about Ni No Kuni 2, and I don't really have... It was a game that came out...
It was a game. We live in a society.
We live in a society. Yeah, I mean, go back to my article where I was like, Ni No Kuni 2 could have been so much more. I mean, it really could have been so
it
much
could
more.
Could have.
I mean, maybe there's an argument to be made for it being like just kind of a pretty, very casual RPG, and if you don't think about the story too much, it can be fine.
The problem with that is, and this is something I think you brought up in one of your articles back in the day, was it has these moments where it absolutely wants you to think about its story, and you can't help but think about it because there's a friggin' nuclear bomb blowing up in your face and your child's eyes are melting.
Yeah. Oh, God, the dissonance there is so weird.
Yeah, and that was, like, right at the end of the game. That was like, oh, here's what happened to that nuclear bomb in the last, like, 10 minutes of the game. Thanks, guys. I appreciate that.
I don't want to defend Ni No Kuni 2, but... I think that there is a subset of people who maybe would go into it going, wow, this is really pretty. And like, I'm not too fussed about like how shallow the combat is. Like, it's like fun and relaxing and the characters are kind of fun and the world is vibrant and it's like playing a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah, I know. I see where you're coming from, but I just spent a whole bunch of time defending Pokemon Let's Go, which is a game that knows exactly what it is and what it wants to be. Ni No Kuni 2 doesn't know what it wants to be.
So what you're saying, it's a level 5 RPG then?
More or less. I'm trying to think of the last level 5 RPG I played. Fantasy Life was pretty good.
So we went through this entire discussion, Nadia, and we never even talked about Dragon Quest XI, but I think that's fine. Because I think we're going to wrap this up in the final episode of the year in which we pick our favorite RPGs of 2019. So we're done recapping it. We're going to have one final conversation about Dragon Quest XI as we finish things up. But in the meantime, I mean, that was the year in RPGs. What did you think of the year in RPGs? Were there any that we missed that you thought were really great? I'm sure that there are some Pillars of Eternity 2 Deadfire aficionados in the audience. Perhaps somebody wants to come out of the woodwork and defend Kingdom Come Deliverance to me. I mean, please do, I guess. but yeah, no, I mean, I think that it was a good year in RPGs, but I'm hoping next year is better.
Yeah, as I said, it was a very solid year. It had some great games, had actually some of my favorite games of the year, but like I said, 2017's surprises, that really just jazzed me up. So hopefully we have good games next year and some surprises, and I'll be covered.
I think that's emblematic of the year in general, where like I'm going to look at this year and go, well, there's no like breakout. This is the game, right? This game was the biggest game, the most impressive game. Like, Monster Hunter World is probably it, ultimately.
Yeah.
Maybe Octopath Traveler, perhaps Dragon Quest XI. You can make the case for that. But I think Fallout 76 was supposed to be the big one, and it fell completely flat on its face. And yeah, this year might be defined by that.
Oof. Yeah. Ouch. The year that Fallout 76 cratered.
I mean, we'll talk about this next week, but there are already like at least 4 RPGs that for next year that I'm more excited about than anything that came out this year. Pokemon Gen 8, Fire Emblem, the new Fire Emblem. The Outer Worlds, and potentially Cyberpunk. And if like those 4 games come out, oh my God, it'll be a good year.
We're also looking at, we might be looking at Shin Megami Tensei 4.
SMT 5, Shenmue 3. Kingdom Hearts 3. Yep. Like, it's almost like the lull, right? Calm before the storm.
Yes. Calm before the storm. So enjoy it while you can. Get in all that RDR 2.
We'll talk about that more next year. Okay, Nadia, last week we had a big conversation about whether or not Persona 4 or Persona 5 should be going on the top 25 RPG countdown, and lots of people, tons of people, 62 people at last count on, had very long opinions, so thank you for that. The thing I find interesting about this, Nadia, the early voting went to Persona 4 and the late voting went to Persona 5, but in the end, Persona 4, I would say, got the preponderance of votes.
Yes, not just on the comment section, but also on Twitter as well. There were people contributing to that and people making their voices known on Facebook, just everywhere. People have opinions about Persona.
They sure do. I think the common thing is, it kind of mirrored our conversation in the last episode. The people who leaned Persona 4 talked up its characters and everything, and the people who leaned Persona 5 talked up its mechanical improvements and the soundtrack, and they also really hated Yosuke and Teddy.
They really hated you. Yeah, and I can't exactly defend Yosuke or Teddy.
Yeah.
Although I did try, I did bring up a couple of points in my write-up, which you read this now, by the way, our final verdict between Persona 5 and Persona 4, hint, it was Persona 4. But I did mention, I did feel for him at times, when he has this crush on his senpai, who just, he finds out, she just despises him and puts up with him, and it's just oh, that actually hurt. I feel for you.
I think emblematic of the conversation is this email or this comment by Sigizar. Persona 4 emphasized school life and connections and had a year-long murder mystery, while Persona 5 emphasized city life, and while it tried to be a heist movie in terms of social justice, it didn't emphasize your bond with the characters as much, not really utilizing their strengths as good as I would have hoped. Plus, you spend fourth of the school year in prison. I would give the edge to Persona 4, even if Persona 5 had much better gameplay.
Yeah, and something I also pointed out in my piece, that to all credit to Atlas, is very clearly wanted Persona 5 and Persona 4 to be very different thematic-wise and story-wise, and they are. But, and that is why, I guess, you don't have so many of the bonds in Persona 5, because you are a paroled student who has to make friends from scratch, because nobody likes or trusts you, and all of your friends you do make are very damaged in their own ways.
Yeah. And then, A Mighty Squall 958 says, as much as I love Persona 4 Golden, I found on revisiting the game with a more critical eye that the character writing is not as strong as I thought on first playthrough. Does Chie and Yosuke's relationship change that much? How about Kanji and Yukiko's? The characters do change, but it all stems through their growing trust in you and you only. In that way, I find, although I'm not a booster for 3, I think Persona 3 ultimately has the strongest character writing of the modern Personas. Is Persona 4 Golden an all-time classic? Yes. Is Persona 5? Perhaps. I'm very curious how time will treat 5 as a cultural time capsule that it is. And it really is. A lot of people were talking about how Persona 5 really does kind of beat you over the head with its themes. And then Benjamin Linus 86, he is a Persona 5 defender, says, I know y'all are going to pick Persona 4, but I think Persona 5 is a strictly better game in basically every way. The dungeons are far better designed than the randomly generated nonsense of P4. The combat is a huge improvement. I can't go back to an SMT game without baton pass anymore. And the customizability in demon recruiting and fusing is the best it's ever been. The story is only slightly stronger than P4, in contrast to the gameplay systems, which are way better. And it admittedly suffers from some mid-game slog, but it picks up back up for a strong finish. As for the soundtrack, it's music to start a goddamn revolution to. Listen to Rivers in the Desert and tell me you don't want to punch a fascist. Try me.
I totally agree. I'm actually really looking forward to that, and Life Will Change in Smash.
Oh man, they are going to put Life Will Change in Smash. I'm so happy.
They are. So am I.
I will say this for the Persona 5 soundtrack. I listen to it in its entirety regularly.
So do I. I absolutely do when I'm working.
I can't say that for Persona 4.
No, although Persona 4 has its moments. Mm. I mentioned the name of the soundtrack I was talking about last week was Memories, that pops up in that that last dungeon, the bonus dungeon. That's a great song. But yeah, I give it to 5 easy.
Yeah, so my main takeaway from this is that people really freaking care about Persona 4 and Persona 5. These are two games that engender a ridiculous amount of passion. And I mean, certainly the series as a whole deserves to be on the top 25 RPG countdown.
Yeah, I think we made a good decision, including at least one. That's for
sure. We did well, Nadia.
We did. Hooray.
We'll continue the top 25 RPG countdown in the new year. I mean, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to touch on the... We're not going to be able to do it coincide with the Suikoden 2 anniversary that's happening this month.
Ah.
Spoiler alert, Suikoden 2 is on this list.
Yeah,
are you surprised?
Like, stunned. Woo-hoo.
I am surprised. Just, like, were you surprised? I was surprised. But yeah, no, we're going to continue with the new year with the top 25 RPG countdown. Finish it up. It's been a fun ride to this. But next week we got a big one for you. It's going to be like 2.5 hours of us talking about all of the biggest games of the year. We got the entire team coming in, including the UK side, Katie, Matt, Mike, all of them. We're all gonna share our thoughts on all of the biggest games of the year, including some of the biggest RPGs. It'll be a special that we put on this feed. So, I mean, you're going to have
the U.S. Gamer Christmas special.
U.S. Gamer holiday special. Ho, 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 ho. or whatever they say for Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
Hanukkah, 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 Hanukkah. We're very inclusive okay. Here on U.S. Axe of
Blood
God.
We're very inclusive.
Axe of Blood God is the U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold, including Spotify. Which is very exciting. Subscribe to us, rate us. If you enjoy us, drop us a line. You can follow me on Twitter at @the_catbot. Nadia is @NadiaOxford. Follow us on Twitter. I'm @the_catbot. Nadia is @NadiaOxford. US Gamer on all of the social media channels, US GamerNet. And we'll be back next week. And if you have a nice thing to say to us, leave us a review. We really appreciate that. And thanks for a really good year of Axe of the Blood God and listening to us ramble about RPGs. We love each and every one of you. Got a couple more episodes and we'll wrap up another year of this podcast. 3 years, Nadia.
Wow. It's been 3 good years.
3 years? 4 years? We're coming up on year 4 in 2019.
We're all getting older, but older and
wiser. I can't believe that this show has been going on for 4 years. It's ridiculous. We're almost up to 200, episode 200. Huh. You know that? We're only 15 episodes away.
Geez, already, yeah. Huh?
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, happy adventuring.